Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we've got a special early episode this week because of the recent situation with tornadoes striking in the Nashville, Tennessee area. We actually found out earlier today that Dr. Joe Holly and his wife, Kimberly, were going to be deployed. Kimberly with her two search and rescue dogs, and Dr. Joe as a field EMS director. We'll find out more about that here in a second. Before we can get to Dr. Joe in the field, though, we're going to bring up Sam, my co-host here, who is tirelessly working behind the scenes to get episodes like this together for everybody.
Well, we know how important it is to the community to keep updated, and especially when Joe and now Kimberly are out in the field, it's exciting for them to kind of get the insider information. So we're going to go right to Joe. They traveled from Memphis to Cooksville, where the biggest part of the damage was. So Joe, I talked to you earlier today, but let me know where you're at and what you're doing and how you got there and what's up with Kimberly.
Well, hi, everybody. Yes, so strangely enough, Kimberly was out on a search about an hour from home for a missing person that had a car that had gone off the roadway into the water. And so they made a find there and was on the way home, and we got a call in regards to Cookeville, Tennessee, which is about an hour from Nashville. Obviously, there was some damage in Nashville, but Cookeville, a relatively small community, took a really big hit. And so they had asked for some canine resources, and then a little while later, the state EMS office asked if I would deploy as well. So Kimberly got out a little bit ahead of me, and I sort of chased them down the highway. We spent a chunk of time getting there today. The dogs went right to work, and I sort of hooked up at the local command center and then was out in the field for most of the afternoon, just kind of overseeing operations there, et cetera. Sort of circle back around this evening to the kind of makeshift morgue facility where many of the fatalities were being identified and that kind of stuff. So I've sort of been all around the scene today for sure, and it's been a relatively hectic day.
So, Joe, can you explain to folks, because this is the first time you've actually been on a state deployment, which I know many states have DMATs that will function as a state resource if the state requires them. Can you explain a bit about how that works?
Certainly. So, as you guys know, the task force is a federal level asset, and in general, the to deploy the task force requires a authorization from the president after a request from a state. But as with many, all as far as I'm aware of the teams in the country, they can be activated by their state as a state asset. And while the entire team was not activated today, because we have some state and regional search and rescue teams in the Middle Tennessee area, they did activate the canine teams to come. And then, of course, my role in the state is just so happens that I also work for the task force. So, my deployment was actually not a direct task force related deployment today.
Yeah, Jamie, and I think Dr. Joe was a little bit jealous when Kimberly got deployed, and he's sitting at home going, am I going to go? Am I going to go? Tables were turned on you,
yes,
Joe.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
Now you know how Kimberly
I know,
felt.
Yeah.
All those times you got
deployed.
Well,
it's true. It was tough. It was tough this morning to know that she was going, and I wasn't sure if I was going to be going or not.
I think that's kind of funny, actually, but Joe, it's not surprising.
Joe, can you give us a sense of the the level of the destruction that was caused in the Cookeville area that you saw? I mean, I've seen pictures that you sent that showed some, like, essentially homes flattened, it looked like, in a residential neighborhood. Is that what you were seeing?
Sure. You saw it correctly. So there were two neighborhoods, a few hundred homes, as best I could tell, that were pretty much completely devastated. Most of the homes were down to, foundations or slabs, and a huge debris field that covered the entire neighborhood. And then a second neighborhood that was almost as bad. So quite devastating damage in these two areas. There's some other areas that I noted in the Nashville area, and then between Nashville and Cookeville, where several warehouses lost their roofs and things like that. But it was definitely a much smaller area of impact until it got to the Cookeville area, and then it was a pretty substantial hit there.
Well, I've been watching the Weather Channel up until a few minutes ago, and my understanding is 25 known deceased. Do you have any more information on illness and injury and deaths in Cookeville area?
Yeah, I think it was 19 the last I heard, 19 fatalities the last I heard. I don't know how much of that is, double identification someone on a missing list or something like that. So, I think those numbers are going to settle around 20 when it's all over, and identification is all complete, et cetera. And then the hospital there had probably 80 or 100 patients throughout the night, a fair number of which, probably 20 or 25% of which, got transported further on to major trauma centers and that kind of stuff. A lot of blunt force trauma, some pretty serious. But they seem to handle it pretty well, considering it's a relatively small community in a somewhat rural area, but it's a very large medical center there, and they really do a great job taking care of things. So they stepped up and did a good job today.
Well, that's certainly good to know. I know they were doing kind of a door-to-door survey, such that there were doors, just to see what they could find. And Jamie's curious about the kind of injury types that were seen and transported and treated. And did they all go to that one main hospital, or were some treated in the field? How did that work?
There were a few relatively minor ones that were taken care of during the night. A lot of flying debris trauma. It's pretty obvious from looking at this, entire neighborhood that's flattened, that the amount of force inflicted was pretty severe. So folks were thrown around and had stuff thrown into them pretty substantially, and so there were quite a number of substantial thoracic and head injuries, as well as major lacerations and that sort of stuff.
Kyle, you had a comment you just threw up there. Do you want to talk about that?
Sure, Sam. So looking at injury patterns and kind of when people typically present to hospitals from some major tornado cases in the past, such as Joplin and then Birmingham, Tuscaloosa, consistent with what Joe is saying, we typically see at the hospital setting, you'll see the blunt force penetrating trauma present first. Typically, they're delivered by pickup trucks, vehicles, or anyone that can get to those hospitals, sometimes walking wounded if you're able to self-ambulate and get there in the initial stages following the event. Following that, typically you'll then see the musculoskeletal traumas and penetrating traumas, so extremity injuries, things of that nature. As Joe said, like head injuries, things like that, the more serious stuff. Once people begin to get triaged in the front yards of the impacted communities and are able to then be transported either by a personal vehicle or perhaps ambulance if those are still available. And we'll see things evolve from there. But initially, you'll kind of get that quiet period. You're like, wow, what's happening? I haven't seen anyone. And then all of a sudden that surge comes. And typically it's not going to be your EMS providers delivering those. It's going to be the citizens on the ground that are the initial first responders.
Yes, something to be said for preparedness, methinks. Joe, how is the 911 system prepared for? Were they compromised in some way? Were they just overwhelmed? Do you have a sense of that yet?
I don't have a lot of information on that. It seemed to be very functional today. The cell coverage in the community there is pretty good. And there were several major wireless carriers with, wireless mobile transmitters up already that really got the cell service back online very quickly. So as far as I know, everything was working pretty well there. Clearly, a lot of power outages, mostly in those communities, and the rest of the communities seem to be fairly intact with minimal damage.
Well, that's good. Yeah, we heard there were a lot of outages. No surprise there. So, Becky, you were probably at AccuWeather today. Did you get a sense of what the latest is on casualties and deceased folks?
Yeah, Sam, so the number I'm seeing is the one that you quoted. That's 25, and that's coming from the Tennessee Emergency Management Agency. So the most deaths are coming from a few counties, Davidson, Wilson, and Putnam counties. They're saying 25 confirmed. A state of emergency has been declared by the governor. Still significant amount of people without power. And the National Weather Service is in the process of completing surveys to determine what the rating is. So some preliminary ratings. So for Germantown, North Nashville, EF2, which is winds of 125 miles per hour or greater. East Nashville and the Five Points area, EF3, which is 136 to 140 miles per hour. That's about the highest. Donelson and Mount Juliet are both coming in at EF3. I'm not 100% certain where exactly these locations are. I don't see Cookeville listed specifically here, so those storm surveys are probably still ongoing. But usually these take several days by the National Weather Service to get to most of the areas that have been impacted and come up with an assessment to determine the rating of the tornado after the fact.
Jamie, you had a question we discussed earlier today about the National Weather Service and how they classify tornadoes after the fact. Do you want to expand on that a little bit?
Well, I think we've touched on it before in discussions, but I think, you know, given how much devastation has been seen in the coverage that people may have watched of this, and of course the photos that Joe was good enough to send our way, we see such devastation, and I'm always curious how the Weather Service makes that determination. What kind of things do they look for specifically when they go into a community? And, you know, do they look and see how far things are scattered, or do they look at specific debris patterns, or the types of structures and how they're affected? I'm curious if Kyle or Becky have an idea of how they go about this assessment.
I mean, I can hazard a few guesses. Certainly no experts. I've never been on a damage survey, so I would definitely recommend that we get someone from the National Weather Service on in the future. A few things that I do think they look at are in what directions has the damage, particularly trees, have they fallen? So if trees are all down in the same direction, and I'm probably just going to let Kyle talk here, honestly, but it's you know, looking at trees, I think aerial coverage helps a lot. You often see the drone and helicopter footage. But I'm going to toss it to Kyle because he's much more an expert on this than I am.
Mr. Kyle, I know you've done some of these, so do tell.
Yes, these are particularly challenging for the National Weather Service meteorologists who conduct these damage surveys. So how these are conducted is by it's broken up by the National Weather Service's office area of responsibility. So if they're issuing the warnings for your particular area, they're going to be going out and performing the damage assessment survey following these high impact weather events. And how these will work is we start with, during the warning process, the warning coordination meteorologist, who's the person who is the liaison between the Weather Service office and the local community and their public safety officials. They're going to be start to compile some data of where these reports from citizens, from responders and others were received. From there, we start to look at the severity of those reports and what additional information is contained, and we get a plan together for the following day, and as Becky indicated, the following days that these widespread damage surveys will take. And they'll send out either one or perhaps multiple teams, depending on their capabilities at the, that time, to look at what are called degree of damage indicators. And so these are 28 kind of sets of damage where we go out into the field as meteorologists and we look at the damage that was imparted upon structures, trees, and other both built and natural things in the environment. And from there, we use those degree of damage indicators to infer a range of wind speeds based on scientific research that caused that level of damage. So that's why you heard Becky at the beginning giving some of those ranges. So for, say, the East Nashville Five Points area, a 136 to 140 mile an hour winds, that's the level of wind that may have caused or could have caused the level of damage that was observed by those meteorologists on the ground. And over such a widespread area, it can take several days because we're still navigating the same roads and the same paths as those people that are getting out, getting those initial life safety issues taken care of and contained. And so that's what those damage surveys look like. And we can only assign those numbers to a tornado after it has occurred, not based on the size, the pictures, the radar indications or anything just yet. Those numbers are assigned following that. And so we'll see more of those numbers come out as those surveys continue.
Perfect. That's great information, you guys. Joe, any thoughts on that?
No, I think you covered it nicely. You know, there's a lot to look at and a lot of different things to take into account, and obviously the a lot of variability depending on ground terrain and that sort of stuff. Part of this community was on a hillside and sort of running down into a valley, and so the tornado would skip and jump and that sort of stuff based on the terrain. So that just makes it more complicated.
Well, I heard something interesting today on the Weather Channel that Tennessee has more tornadoes at night than anywhere else, and I did not know that. So, Becky, I'm going to go back to you on this. Has this to do with geography, with water from the Gulf? Can you give us some idea why that would happen?
Oof, that's a tough question, Sam, and I'm not sure I have a good answer. I think in this case, and if Kyle knows more about the setup, because I'm honestly not particularly in touch with the forecast right now. My focus has been elsewhere. But in this case, just the setup was such that, you know, storms and rain was the pattern was where those were going off to the west. And as the sun set, I think energy kind of just kicked up and fueled the storms a little bit more. And so they actually strengthened overnight. It doesn't happen too often. And I should do more research and figure out, you know, if there's something with the terrain, something with the area that causes that to be more of an occurrence in Tennessee and kind of the, you know, what part of the country? It's Southern Ohio Valley. I don't know. Short answer, I don't know what causes there to be more nighttime tornadoes in that part of the country. That's a good question. If Kyle has any ideas.
Yeah, because it was new information for me. Kyle, what do you think?
Well, Sam, it's a challenging combination of factors. The unfortunate reality is that in the evening times, people aren't paying attention to the weather. You know, this event, it was admittedly quite isolated, and in addition, it makes it challenging to reach people, the citizens, with this immediate life safety and warning information in the evening hours. Because once you turn off that evening news and you go to bed and you lay down for the night, more often than not, you know, you're thinking you're here in, you know, early March, the first thought in your mind isn't, oh, I need to look at my NOAA weather radio and see if it's on alert mode for the is it on alert mode to monitor for those weather hazards that may impact me that night? Is my phone next to my bed so that I can hear if the wireless emergency alert goes off on it and I need to take action? So the communication aspect is a huge part of this. In addition to that, there's also, it's kind of, Tennessee kind of right on that border between Dixie Alley. So you're looking across Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, that southeastern tier of states versus Tornado Alley going from, the Dakotas down through Oklahoma and Texas. In Dixie Alley, you typically see a surge in tornado activity in the spring and fall times as the as the weather patterns change, where you have your typical summer peak in Tornado Alley. And this is kind of one of those early sort of out of the norm, if you will, type of events. But it really does hint at the importance of having multiple ways to receive these weather alerts, be they watches, warnings, or advisories at any time of day, because in this case, this is an unfortunate reminder of how tornadoes can occur any time of year anywhere in the United States where those conditions become favorable for those tornadoes to develop.
And any time of day. Becky, you have a solution for that. You want to throw that out?
Yeah, there's really two. I mean, one is the NOAA weather radio, as Kyle mentioned. It's really a necessary tool for any household to have. I saw someone post on Twitter that it should be something that's part of the home inspection, and I kind of agree. I think all homes that are in tornado-prone regions like Tornado Alley and Dixie Alley should have a NOAA weather radio that can wake you up and alert you. But also in the most severe of situations, which is going to be a tornado warning and a flash flood emergency, your phone through the wireless emergency alert system will also notify you as long as you do not have them turned off. So really encourage people to go into their phone settings and check these alerts. It's going to be things like Amber Alerts are also included in this, but keep those severe weather emergency notifications turned on because they're intended to notify you at times that you're probably not paying attention. You're not looking at your phone. You're not aware of what's going on outside. You're not listening to the radio or the TV. And it's so important to have those notifications that will wake you up and allow you to get to shelter with enough time, because unfortunately that was not the case for many of the people that suffered injuries or passed away in last night's tornado.
Great info. Very good info. In fact, I'm going to check my phone as soon as we're off this call. So Joe, with tornadoes, I guess during daylight hours, you can see them, which is a factor. But when the warnings go off, the warnings go off. And like this one came in hot and fast, it sounds like. So would it have made a huge difference in this case? Or are daytime tornadoes easier to be prepared for? I don't know.
Well, the darkness makes it much more difficult to figure out what's going on, and you're in bed and, all the things that make you not necessarily want to get up and get moving or perhaps take it as seriously as you should. It does sound like this came in pretty quickly. But I don't know anything about the warnings related to it and all that sort of stuff. So, nighttime just adds another layer of complexity to affect the amount of time available to warn folks.
Becky, I got into a little chat on the community today. I don't know if you had time to look at it, probably not. But Dan McGuire, our CISM guy, and Steve Holmes, who's one of our regulars, were talking about some of the after effects in terms of mental health and so forth. And Steve even mentioned a medical condition that I hadn't heard about. And we're going to actually touch that in another show. But you're so in tune with mental health, especially in terms of weather-related stuff. What kind of things should people expect, especially those who had significant damage or maybe lost someone that hadn't been in this situation before?
Yeah, that's a great question, Sam, and a great thing to touch on. People who have gone through severe weather events like this do actually suffer from PTSD, which is post-traumatic stress disorder. And that can be people whose, you know, homes were destroyed, people who have friends who went through it, even people who forecast the event, but were, you know, didn't actually suffer damage themselves. There's also something called secondary trauma, which is something a lot of meteorologists and forecasters may experience from forecasting the event, seeing the damage, particularly those who do the NWS damage surveys. And it's a tough thing to grapple with. You know, as someone who has survived a disaster, it's very easy to understand why they might be traumatized. You know, living through a tornado, particularly one at night when you're supposedly safe and sound in your home, is terrifying. But then for the people who, you know, forecast the event and go in afterwards, they may not feel like they're allowed to feel these emotions and feel devastated and feel upset, but it's trauma regardless. And it's seeing the damage caused by a tornado is shocking. I mean, Kyle described some of the injuries and I'm trying to get my head around that, and it's tough. And so it's one of those things where you hope that the resources are there. You know, the psychological first aid is of great use in situations like this. I don't know. I'm sure Joe knows about that. So it's too bad he had to hop off the call. But just keeping in mind that, you know, along with the physical injuries and the loss of physical things like somebody's home, these people are going to be dealing with the emotional side effects for a very, very long time, if not for the rest of their lives, because this was a very traumatic event that they just went through.
I totally agree. Boy, especially, you know, you said something that kind of resonates, that hitting you at night when you are feeling in a safe mode, and then suddenly the house comes apart. I can well imagine. Kyle, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, Sam, I think that absolutely speaks to the human side of these disasters that we, you know, are often, you know, sometimes hinted at for a little while, but then sometimes tossed to the side as the next major news story comes up. And it's ultimately, it's about the human impact. And you've heard me say this in previous episodes, but we can throw all the data and numbers and facts and figures at you that we can, but until we talk about what was actually experienced by the survivors of this event and of those that responded to it, and really getting that perspective, I think that's so vitally important, because once we tell that story, that's where change can begin. That's where we can start to affect a change in mindset, a change in thinking, and a change in policies, procedures, and how we as a responder community and as a medical community and how we as a weather community and how we as general citizens can start to change our way of thinking and our way of responding to these events. And from previous high-impact tornado events, and I know, you know, to put this in that same category is very presumptuous at this point, but I would offer you, if you want to read the human side of severe weather and specifically tornado disasters, two books that I strongly recommend, 541 by Randy Turner and John Hacker, and the second is What Stands in a Storm by Kim Cross. Two of the most powerful books I've ever read about the impacts, the human impact of weather disasters like tornadoes.
Oh, yeah, I want to get those titles. That's something I'd be very interested in. We actually are going to do at least one podcast, you know, based on that topic, because there's so much to it. So, Jamie, Joe had to fall off, but I'm not surprised. I'm amazed that we got him for the better part of half an hour. And he didn't go into too much detail on it, but Kimberly has actually had all of these things happen, these local rescues and so forth, in the last few days and last few weeks and even the hour up to when this all happened. So she's going to have a lot to talk about. We're going to devote an episode to her. And she took both her dogs, both her cadaver dog and her live rescue dog. And so that should be interesting, too, is to see what kind of experience she has with them on this one. So I'm tossing it back to you, and we're about done here for now.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, folks, we talk a lot about, you know, thanking our sponsor, Paragon Medical Education Group. I'll just do a quick pitch because Joe's not here to do that. But, you know, this episode's a perfect example of the type of training and education you get from the Paragon Medical Education Group. And that's because people like Joe and Kimberly and Jim Logan and the rest of the team are boots on the ground, personally experienced disaster responders. And they can bring to your service a level of experience and expertise that you seldom find in other training situations and setups. And add to that the fact that they can customize just about anything you need to your budget, to your needs, to your organization. It's really a no-brainer. So reach out to them at ParagonMedicalGroup.com. You can also find them over at ParagonMedEDU at Twitter. And there are links both on our Disaster Podcast Facebook group and over at DisasterPodcast.com on every single episode. You know, it doesn't hurt. Reach out to them. Fill out their contact form. Get in touch with them. Have a phone call. I think you'll be very satisfied with the result that you end up with. And Sam can attest to this too. People we've talked to that come out of training sessions with them just talk about it as groundbreaking and once-in-a-lifetime experience, which you just don't hear from, you know, first responders coming out of their, you know, annual training sessions. So that should give you an idea of what you can expect to get from them. Anyway, this important episode, we're going to be doing more follow-ups on this event, but we wanted to get this out to you a little early this week since it was so timely. I'll wrap up and just kind of pitch it real quick to Becky and Kyle for final thoughts and their contact information. So, Becky, why don't you go first?
Yeah, I'm just going to co-sign Kyle's recommendation for the book, What Stands in a Storm, if you want to get an idea for the human impact of tornadoes. It's a tough one to get through, but such an important read, and I think it's great that Kyle mentioned that. You can find me on Twitter at WX_Bex, and as always, on the Disaster Podcast Facebook page.
Kyle, how about you?
Well, Jamie, folks can find me under the handle WX Kyle Nelson on all the social media places, as well as on the Disaster Podcast Facebook group. And I will extend a peace offering to any of those that need to reach out and talk following traumatic events like this, whether you're hearing it and living it vicariously, looking at things remotely, or you were impacted by the event. Please do reach out. You're never alone. You're not alone. And we are here for you.
I'll second that.
Important and definitely important. And I hope people will remember that for any kind of situation they're in. You know, the Disaster Podcast community is a team. We've all dealt with these types of things in various levels and forms. And there's a group of people that can sympathize and empathize with you in these situations. Sam, how can folks reach out to you?
Well, on social media, I'm under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11, and I've been spending most of the day today in the community, and we've been having some good chats there. We're pushing 700, Jamie, so it's getting bigger and bigger, and on the disasterpodcast.com website. What about you?
Well, under the handle PodMedic in most social media locations, so I'd love to catch up with folks there, and as Sam said, our disaster podcast Facebook group is growing all the time. Just search for Disaster Podcast Group and it'll pop right up. Request to join. We'll get you in there right away. Lots of the experts we've had on the show are in the group and available to answer questions. Plus, our membership is comprised of people from all levels of response, from citizen responders all the way up through health department personnel, emergency managers, physicians, and responders of all types. So it really is a great community to be part of, and we'd love to have you there as well. Sam, you know, important that we got this call together tonight on short notice because it's important to let people know that we got access to people like Joe and Kimberly and others that can give us reports from the field in the midst of a deployment, which is pretty amazing.
It is, and Dr. Joe is seriously committed to this community and to bringing you this information, and we so appreciate that because we know that's what you're hungry for. He just let us know he lost a signal, but I'm glad it was at the end of the podcast. But we're going to get him back and his wife, Kimberly, with all kinds of exciting information down the line, perhaps even later this week. But this is one of the clearest indications that disaster weather is not our everyday weather.